Guess what I'm going to talk about today? Well, we are still continuing our series, which has to be the longest series I've ever started, and I'm beginning to wonder if it will ever end. It won't end today. But we do need to continue on with the basic understanding we're trying to grasp of the very important subject of sin. We have discussed in sermons past what sin is, why God hates sin, and last time we spent a good deal of time discussing why we still sin. Now, we did not finish that, so we need to continue in that basic vein of why do we still sin when we see sin as being such a terrible evil? Why is it that we're still involved in it? Why is it still a part of our lives? We talked last time, and I extensively covered the principle that the main reason is because we're all mentally deranged, and explained what I meant by that, and I trust that you've come to understand that more fully as well, and realize that in essence we all are a part of a deranged society. We are in essence like children brought up in an institution for the criminally insane. And if you are brought up in that kind of an environment, your perceptions of right and wrong, your perceptions of reality, are certainly going to be altered. And when you are brought out of that institution, there is certainly a great deal of re-education that must take place before we really come to see reality as it is, as God sees it. Because after all, that's the one reality that counts. So we talked about that extensively last time and began to move on to the area of recognizing that there are certain destructive thought patterns that we all have allowed to be a part of our lives, destructive thought patterns which allow us to continue to sin even in the face of all the evidence that sin makes no sense whatsoever, that sin is, in essence, the ultimate insanity, that sin always produces wrong results. It produces things we don't want. It produces suffering and death and cuts us off from God. And when we have had the experience of not being cut off from God, the experience of actually communicating with the Creator of all the universe, the One who literally rules and reigns on a continuing basis, and we have known that we have come into the presence of that being and had our prayers heard, that individual has intervened in our lives to call us out and to begin molding and shaping us, to forgive sin, to make His Spirit available, the concept or the thought that we could then do something to cut ourselves off from that very special relationship is something that would certainly point out to us that sin does not produce good results. If that were the only bad result, sin would be something we should avoid. But of course, the results are much worse as well, ultimately leading to eternal death. So we talked last time about two of the basic thought patterns that people have that cause them to sin. One being a failure to recognize sin for what it is. A failure to look at sin, label it as sin, recognize this action, this activity, this thought in my life really is sin. When we fail to recognize it, then we don't eliminate it. Yet we talked about the sins of ignorance and how God says you're still guilty, that there is no excuse for sin, that we cannot excuse sin by someone else's actions. We cannot say this person made me sin, though sometimes we've all tried that. And children try it. We've seen children try it when you ask them, why did you do this? And they will come up with some of the most outlandish excuses. As we become older, we're sophisticated enough that our excuses are not so obviously outlandish. Though nonetheless, if we examine them, they're just as outlandish. Because no one can make you sin. Sin is a choice which you make. So we must recognize sin for what it is. We also talked about the fact that we can develop destructive habits, and that those habits can lead us to sin. that because we have done something a certain way over and over and over again, it continues to lead us into sin. We talked about the need to break those habits. Now we need to move on, because there are several other destructive thought patterns that can lead us into the result that we sin, that we are cut off from God, that we reap the suffering, and unless something is done, we'll eventually reap eternal death. Sometimes we sin because we yield to Satan's enticements. Now, we must realistically recognize that Satan is an enticer. Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4. This is a famous confrontation between Jesus Christ and Satan. And we find as we begin in verse 1. Then was Jesus led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. Now, we can refer to that as a test. Well, he's just being tested in this case. But if we go further, when he'd fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was afterward and hungered. And when the tempter came to him, then he said, if you be the Son of God, command these stones be made bread. So on. This was not simply a test. It was a temptation, an enticement to do evil. And Satan was appealing to the basic drive for survival that Jesus Christ had. And he said, just look at these rocks. You know, they look kind of like rounded stones. They look kind of like little loaves of bread. And you could imagine if you had not eaten anything for 40 days, that when someone mentioned bread, every nerve ending in your body would remember bread. You could remember the smell, the texture, the flavor. It would be quite an inducement at that point, especially if you had the power to do it, which, of course, Jesus Christ did have. The problem would be that he would be obeying Satan, doing what Satan said. Not going to do that. But in this case, we find in the beginning of verse 3 that he is labeled as the tempter. That is one of the offices that he has the ability to fulfill. He is a tempter. That's part of what he does. That's part of his job description. He is one who does try to entice, to lead us in wrong directions. Now notice some other examples of this. 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 26. It's been talking here about the way Timothy is instructed to conduct himself and how he should not get involved in empty disputes with people that are not leading to some positive result. And he talks about the approach in verse 25 that he should take. In verse 26, though, it goes on to say, because this is the point we want to point out, and that they, those who are having this problem, who, as it says in verse 25, oppose themselves, that they may recover themselves. The word recover literally means return to soberness. That they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil, who are taken captive by him at his will, or another translation says, at his leisure. In other words, here are individuals who are so weak that Satan simply looks at this individual and he knows, I can get that one anytime I want him. All I have to do is give the right enticement and that one is gone. I've got him anytime. Now, in that kind of a situation, Satan may not tempt the individual all that much. They may not constantly be fighting this battle because Satan already knows what character is there. There's no need to. Because he knows any time he wants, bang, that one will fall. That's a, as we would say, a gimme. That one just is one we can claim without even having to do the effort. It's ours. So we're shown that Satan is one who has the ability to take some captive through this ability to entice, to try to pull in certain directions. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. Now, Paul has been talking here to the church in Thessalonica, because there are certain problems that have existed there in that congregation. And he is concerned about them, not major problems in the sense of heresy or something along that line, but more in the area of just simply discouragement and some of the other concerns that came along. Some were saying that Paul maybe was just another one of the itinerant preachers that traveled around. He wasn't really God's servant, and there were some questions that began to come up. So Paul was concerned about what was going on, the special trials of that church. So it says in verse 5, "For this cause, when I could no longer forbear, I sent to know your faith." He sent Timothy in this case. I wanted to know what your situation was. "Lest by some means the tempter have tempted you and our labor be in vain." So Paul recognized the ability that Satan had to tempt, to lure those who were recently called into God's way of life. Paul recognized there is a danger there. Now, he goes on to say, as you read the rest of it, I won't take the time because that's not the point, but as you go on and read the rest of it, you see that Paul was very encouraged with the report he received. Well, that's fine. The people are doing very well. That was not the problem. But the point I simply want to make is that Paul recognized Satan's ability to entice an individual to sin. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, in this case, it's talking about the physical sexual relationship that exists in a marriage. He says in verse 5, "Defraud you not one the other." In other words, don't withhold this relationship from one another, except it be with mutual consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. So that's certainly a possibility when someone is concerned about fasting and prayer. They may wish not to have themselves distracted in that way, and that's fine, no problem. They're not going to fast and pray for 40 days and 40 nights, probably. And then he says, "Come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency." In other words, he said, I recognize in this situation, be careful, because Satan will play on your natural human desires. Satan will take advantage of that, and he will tempt you. So be careful. Protect each other. In other words, that's what he's telling a couple, protect each other from Satan's ability to tempt you in this way. It is something that Satan certainly has the power to do. So over and over again, we see Satan described as a tempter. Obviously, that means that there are those who yield to that temptation, who give in to Satan's tempting in whatever area it may be. We each year, though I won't take the time to go through it, but we each year on the Day of Atonement go through Leviticus chapter 16. And in the process of going through the symbolism involved in the Day of Atonement, we point out that there are two goats. One is symbolic of Satan. And it says the sins of the people are laid upon that goat and he is sent away. He's not killed because, as we recognize, Satan is a spirit being, won't be killed. But there is another goat, and the sins of the people are confessed over that other goat too. And it is slaughtered and the blood sprinkled as a sign that sin produces death. So the Day of Atonement reminds us that there are two parties involved where sin takes a hand in people's lives. There is your personal responsibility, and there's also Satan's responsibility. So we certainly should recognize. We would not be adequately looking at the subject of sin and why do people sin if we ignored the fact that, yes, Satan does tempt. Satan does want you to fail. Now, in that sense, I think we should also look at James chapter 1. James chapter 1. And let's read verse 13 and 14. He says, "Let no man say when he is tempted, I'm tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempts he any man." There's another translation, well, let's say another paraphrase. It's not really a translation, but I like the way it's phrased. For God never wants to do wrong and never tempts anyone else to do it. And that is at least the sense of what's said. God is not tempted. God is not tempted with evil. Satan does not have the power to tempt God. At the same time, we should recognize he does tempt. Now, God is not a tempter. God does not tempt you to do evil. God doesn't want you to fail. Satan, on the other hand, is a tempter who wants you to fail. So he will place every enticement that he can. Then it says, for every man is tempted. What is the situation? What conditions exist that enable temptation to take place and to produce the results Satan wants it to produce? Every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Now remember, James was an individual who was well aware of the profession of fishing. He was a professional fisherman. He was not a sport fisherman. He was a professional fisherman. He knew about it. This particular term, drawn away, is a term that he would be especially familiar with because it specifically refers to one boat taking another boat in tow behind it. Throwing a rope back and taking it in tow. What happens when you do that? No matter where the second boat is, the one that's being taken in tow, no matter where it is, it pulls in and comes right behind the other one. It follows right down the line. So it says that when you are tempted, you can become drawn away. You can be taken in tow by your own lust. So that you may not be headed that way initially, but if you allow that temptation to produce the wrong thoughts in you, then you begin to come right in line with exactly what Satan wants you to do. So we must recognize God is not a tempter, but Satan is. Sometimes people sin because they yield to that temptation. We need to recognize that. We shouldn't be foolish as we deal with Satan's world and somehow think that on our own we have the ability to fight, resist, not have any problem with it. No, we will have problems with it. The more closely we're involved with this world, the more we're going to have problems with it. Recognize there is a danger there. There is a danger as you become involved with this world of being tempted and lured in that direction. So be very careful about it. A fourth reason, a fourth pattern of thinking that produces sin even when we know sin is wrong. The Bible makes it very clear to us, wrong associations can lead to sin. Now, no one can make you sin. That still stands. But associating with individuals who are involved in that way of living certainly can lead you into a situation where sin becomes much easier. One of the most famous scriptures about that is Psalm 1. Psalm 1. Most of you could probably quote it, at least this version that we sing. Psalm 1, verse 1. Blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. And then it goes on and talks about the blessings that will come to him. And in verse 4, the ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, the way of the ungodly shall perish. So God tells us that if you become the kind of individual who walks in the counsel of the ungodly, I don't misunderstand that. When God talks about the ungodly, He is not necessarily talking about people who go around as Satan worshipers. He's just talking about people for whom God is not the supreme ruler, who have something else that they use as their standard determining what's good and what's evil. Those are people who are not godly. They are ungodly in that sense. So blessed is the person who doesn't walk in their counsel, doesn't stand in the way of sinners, doesn't sit in the seat of the scornful. Now there's a certain progressive action there. One step leads to the next, which leads to the next. So we should certainly be aware of that progression, but realize God is warning us. If you begin to have close associations with those whose values are wrong. It's going to affect your values. You're going to look at things differently. I remember a number of years ago, a minister, I can't even remember who it was at this point, talked about the process of becoming involved with the world and beginning to draw back from God's church. And he said, I can tell you what will happen. He said, if you begin to have your primary associations with the world and you're not that involved with the church, you may come every Sabbath, might even come to Bible studies, you may come to certain church activities and so on, but before long, you're going to begin to look at church people as if they're a little strange, as if something's odd about them, as if you're not quite like they are, as if something is different about you as opposed to the way they are. And of course, as a human being, when we see that someone's different than we are, we automatically assume that they must be wrong. So, he said, that's what will happen to you. And frankly, I've seen that process happen over and over again. Individuals who begin to stand back and before long begin to themselves be critical. First of all, of people within the church. Then generally the next step involves leadership within the church. And the next step generally involves belief within the church. And of course, the next step is out the door. So we need to recognize the danger that if we allow ourselves to primarily associate with those who don't have right values, we're going to have the same values. Wrong associations lead to sin. Now, realistically, though I don't want to dwell on it a great deal, realistically, we have to recognize that not everyone, even among us, has the same values we have. And therefore, we must recognize that, not that we're supposed to go around being judgmental of one another, but at the same time, we should recognize, sometimes I think the way it comes up to me is, someone will say, let's say they have a teenager, and let's say two teenagers want to date. And they will say, well, you know, it must be okay because after all, both of them are in the church. Both of them are here at services and so on. It doesn't mean the values are the same. You need to evaluate, just like, in a sense, many people in the world would evaluate before they would let their children associate with certain others. They'd evaluate and say, wait a minute, does this person have the kind of standards and values I would want them to have? You have that responsibility. Not every parent parents in the same way. And there may be different values. And you ought to look at that. Recognize it. In Exodus chapter 23. Exodus 23. God gave the people of Israel specific instruction. He says in verse 27, I'll send my fear before you and will destroy all the people to whom you shall come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs unto you. Which means, obviously, they're leaving. They're running away. I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, the Hittite from before you. And he goes on and says, I won't do it all at one time, but a little by little, so that you can properly take care of the land. He says, I'll set your bounds, in verse 31, from the Red Sea, even to the Sea of the Philistines, the desert to the river, for I'll deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. Then he says, you shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So God told ancient Israel, when you go into the land, I don't want you simply to go in and allow the people of the land to continue there. Because frankly, if they continue, they're going to affect you. And it's going to lead you in the direction of sin. So again, shouldn't that same principle apply to us? That we recognize we cannot have close relationships with those who, in essence, worship other gods, or we're going to be drawn in the same way. The effect will be the same. In Exodus 32, Exodus 32, different situation comes up. You remember in Exodus 32, Aaron has built the people a golden calf, and now Moses has come down, found out about it, and has taken very severe action. A number of people have died as a result of it. And we come to verse 21. Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people unto you that you have brought so great a sin upon them?" Now, in other words, here is a person, Aaron, who is supposed to be living the right way. He was established as the high priest. But in this case, Aaron made some very serious mistakes. And God said, look, or Moses spoke to him directly, but as God's servant, said, "What happened here that you brought this sin upon the people?" In other words, again, it tells us that associating with those who have the wrong values can bring sin upon you. When someone is doing something the wrong way, even a person who is basically trying to live the right way, if they start doing what's wrong, it's going to affect you. It's going to have an effect. So God recognizes that. Now we find another example in 1 Samuel chapter 2. We covered this in Bible study, but very few of you heard it. 1 Samuel chapter 2. We'll find it here in verse 12. 1 Samuel 2, verse 12. Now the sons of Eli were sons of Belial. And as we covered in the Bible study, Belial evidently, at least from one source, comes from two words, Beli, meaning without, and Ya'al, meaning worth, something without worth. So sons of Belial refers to those who are worthless. The sons of Eli were the sons of Belial. They knew not the Lord. Now they were priests. They knew who God was. They heard about Him. But as far as actually knowing God in a personal relationship, they didn't. The priest custom with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant came while the flesh was in seething with a flesh hook of three teeth in his hand. And he struck it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the flesh hook brought up, the priest took for himself. So they did in Shiloh unto all the Israelites that came there. Now, why would they do this? Is this the way God had prescribed for things to be done? No, God had given them specific inheritance or what they were to receive from all the sacrifices. There was a specific portion that God had assigned to the priests. He said, of every sacrifice that comes up, this is yours. Now, some of the sacrifices belonged to the priest entirely. Some sacrifices were consumed by the fire entirely. But for the most part, virtually every sacrifice that came up, there was a portion that was given to the priests. But these two fellows decided, we don't want just that. We'd like something else. In fact, not only would we like something else, we'd like more. We don't think we're getting enough. We want more. So they set up their own system. And they said they would stick this treble hook in and take out whatever they could get. So they did this to everyone that came up. And verse 15, also before they burnt the fat, the priest's servant came and said to the man that sacrificed, "Give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have sodden flesh of you, but raw." And if any man said to him, "Let them not fail to burn the fat first, then take as much as your soul desires," then he would answer him, "No, but you shall give it me now. And if not, I'll take it by force." So again, they wanted something that God didn't give to them. "Wherefore, the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord. For men abhorred or dealt contemptuously with the offering of the Lord." Now here we see another situation where these individuals were obviously doing what was wrong. And yet, other people in reaction also did what was wrong. So it showed that here were individuals, and you certainly would have to say what they're doing is wrong. It is absolutely wrong. God did not then come to the rest of the Israelites and say, oh, well, it's okay for you to react the way you are because, after all, they're doing something wrong. No, they were still guilty of sin. Now, how would we apply that today? Obviously, not too many of you are having a problem with priests stealing your sacrifices. It doesn't go that way today. But how many times have you justified what is wrong because of what someone else did? How many times have you justified being upset with your mate, with your children, saying things that you had no business saying because someone else said what they shouldn't say or did what they shouldn't do? So many times I've talked with couples who are having marriage problems, and it will be, oh, well, I would do what I'm supposed to do if only they would do what they should. If they would fulfill their part, then I would do mine. As if somehow it's okay for you to sin. Because, see, failing to do what you know is right is sin. Remember, we covered that a month and a half ago or so. Failing to do what's right is sin. And just because someone else doesn't do what's right doesn't change that fact. Sin is not determined by what someone else does. Sin is an absolute standard. God's law defines it, tells us what it is. It doesn't change. So these people were guilty of sin because of, in a sense, the sin of these priests. We go on down to verse 24. Eli is speaking to them. Verse 23. He said unto them, why do you such things? For I hear of your evil dealings by all the people. Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people to transgress. If one man sin against another, the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against the Lord, who shall entreat for him? Notwithstanding, they hearkened not to the voice of their father, because the Lord was going to slay them. But you see, he says, you make the Lord's people transgress by your sin. So sometimes we must recognize others can influence us. Now, if we're as strong as we should be, well, we won't be influenced that way. It wouldn't affect us in that way. If we're tremendously spiritually strong, then we should be able to go into such a situation, associate with any type of person, and it wouldn't really affect us. We would be able to resist that. I think a good example of that is Jesus Christ, who on occasion dealt with a variety of people that most of us would not deal with. There were several occasions when, for example, he dealt with prostitutes. Now, again, you don't find that Jesus Christ went wandering into a brothel to give his message. You don't find that that happened. But when they came to him, he was willing to deal with them. That's fine. But that certainly was not an advocate. It certainly was not advocating that that's the way we should conduct ourselves. That we go around and associate with prostitutes, drug addicts, etc. Because after all, if we're strong, it won't affect us. No, it's not for us to associate in that way. Obviously, if someone came, then we'd try to help them, but that's a different matter. In 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5. Now, some of you may be thinking of another scripture, but I'm not even going to turn to the one that talks about evil communications. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, in giving instruction to Timothy about dealing with elders, he says in verse 22, lay hands suddenly on no man, neither be partaker of other men's sins. Keep yourself pure. Here was a young evangelist who was admonished by the apostle, be careful, because if you allow the wrong associations in your life, you will become a partaker of other men's sins. What they accept as being all right will seem to you as not to be so bad either. It's just not that bad. We accept it as almost being something that's all right in God's sight. So he warns him, be careful lest you become a partaker of other men's sins. One more scripture on the subject in Revelation 18, verse 4. Revelation 18, verse 4. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, that you receive not of her plagues. Wrong association can lead us to sin. A fifth wrong way of thinking that produces sin. Sometimes people sin because they think no one will ever find out. No one will ever know. After all, who could possibly discover this particular sin, whatever it might be? In Isaiah chapter 30, Isaiah chapter 30, throughout this book, God has been talking to the people of Israel, the approach that they take toward Him and how they refuse to respond. He says in Isaiah 30 and verse 1, "Woe to the rebellious children, says the Eternal, that take counsel, but not of me." Now, we could apply that, as most commentaries do. We could apply it to individuals going out and seeking the help of other nations, of one nation seeking help from another. That certainly is applicable. But I think we ought to take it, frankly, just in the sense it's written. Who seek counsel. They want advice. They want direction. But they don't want it from God. But somehow, we don't want to hear what God has to say in this case. Or in some cases, it may be, well, I already know what God says, but let me hear what some person says. I want counsel, but I don't really want it from God. They say they take counsel, but not from me. That cover with a covering, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin. Well, they cover things up. They cover it over. They gloss it over as if it's no big thing, as if it means nothing. We can find some way to kind of hide it. But the purpose in covering it is so they can add more to it, so they can continue to do more and more and more. If no one asks, if no one examines, then I can get away with it. Now, maybe this is not the best example, but I couldn't help but notice yesterday as I went to my door and opened it up. Probably all of us have the experience where people come along and stuff all kinds of trash in your door, and it's all kinds of things that you have no desire for, you know, aluminum siding on your brick house and things like that. That just makes no sense. And 12 offers a week for pizza, all of those things that come. But yesterday I got one that was, someone was asking for a vote. This particular person was campaigning, I think it was for a school district position or whatever it may have been. But anyway, he was campaigning for a vote. And in his little campaign ad, he said, "You don't have to wait to vote, because you see, the law is set up for absentee votes so that they can't ask you why you want to vote as an absentee vote ballot. They simply have to give it to you to go ahead and vote, and they can't ask you why. So, since nobody's going to ask you, you don't have to wait. You can vote as an absentee ballot right now." Now, I couldn't help but think, is this the kind of person I want in office? Who says, as long as they don't ask you, get away with what you can get away with. If I were a voter, I wouldn't have voted for him. I almost wished I could have contacted him and told him, you know, "You're not going to get my vote." Now, I wouldn't go through all the whole thing, but I felt like saying, you know, I want you to know one reason you're not getting my vote. I won't tell him all the reasons, but I'll tell him that one anyway. You're not going to get it because of that. I couldn't contact him because his campaign literature was already in the trash can. But at the same time, you have to wonder. You look at the approach that's there. As long as I can cover it up, as long as no one knows, it's not really wrong. It's all right. In Psalm 69, David talks of this attitude as well. Psalm 69, verse 5. He says, "O God, You know my foolishness, and my sins are not hid from You." This is one of the things that set David apart. David knew his sins were not hidden from God. God could see them, whatever they were. And therefore, David was not so tempted to sin as others might be. He didn't think, "I can hide it." He did think at one point he could ignore it. We'll look at that later. Psalm 90. Psalm 90, in verse 8. Psalm 90, verse 8. David says, "You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance." You know them. There's no way to hide them. The secret sins God sees. We're told in John, I won't go back there, that men love darkness because their deeds are evil. But God is light. And God can see, even in the darkness, where others can't. God can see everything that's there. Our secret sins are before God. You can't hide them. Proverbs chapter 5. Proverbs 5, verse 20. Proverbs 5, verse 20. He's talking about the sanctity of the marriage relationship. And he says, "Why will you, my son, of a stranger? For the ways of man are before the eyes of the Eternal. And he ponders all his goings." All of them. God knows what's going on when nobody else does. When not one other human being knows. "His own iniquities shall take the wicked himself. He shall be held with the cords of his sins. He shall die without instruction. In the greatness of his folly he shall go astray." God says, "I know what's going on. I'm aware of it." There's no such thing as getting away with sin. Oh, as humans, so many times we want to hide it. And we think, as long as nobody else knows about it, then I got away with it. I don't really have to face it and deal with it. As long as no one else knows, it's still sin. It's still going to produce the result, destruction. And we need to keep that in mind, lest we be tempted to sin, thinking no one will know. God made an interesting promise, Numbers chapter 32. Through the years, I have seen this promise fulfilled over and over again. Sometimes it takes years for it to be fulfilled. But it is fulfilled. Numbers 32. God was talking to the people through Moses about what they were to do as they were beginning to go into the land. Specifically, he was talking in this case to the people of Reuben and Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh, telling them they had a responsibility to the rest of Israel. I won't go through all that. But at this point, he says in verse 23, Numbers 32, 23, it ought to be marked in your Bible if it's not. "But if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Eternal. And be sure, your sin will find you out." It will come out. Remember the old statement that at least my parents used to tell me when I was a little child and I would do something that was wrong, and which I did on occasion, and they would say, they would tell me about it, "Did you do this?" And after I finally had to admit it, I would say, "How did you know?" And the response was, "A little bird told me." Now, frankly, that wasn't true either. But at the same time, it did come from a particular verse in the Bible where it says that if you curse the king, a bird of the air will tell him. And that's a paraphrase, but it's in there. It brings out the point that you don't know exactly how it may come out, but it will. Eventually, it will. So we need to recognize that there's no such thing as hiding sin. We may think it's hidden, and it may be hidden for a while. But at the time you least expect, at the time when it may produce results that you sure didn't want to have produced, it'll come out. So it's much better to deal with it in another way. It's much better to face it and deal with it and not delude ourselves into thinking we can get away with sin as long as no one knows. Because someone always knows. Not necessarily another human being. If you're a young person, not necessarily your parents. They may not always know exactly what you've done. But there is someone who knows. And it will come out. A sixth wrong way of thinking that causes people to sin. Sometimes people sin because they allow themselves to get too close to sin. They allow themselves to get so close that suddenly they go over the edge. Suddenly they're involved with sin. Proverbs chapter 6 gives an example of this. Proverbs chapter 6. In a way that far too many in this society have already experienced. It has been proven for thousands of years. The same result will come about. But human beings still make the same mistakes. They think they can get close to sin. We'll pick it up in verse 27. Proverbs 6, verse 27. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? In other words, God says, look, let's be logical about this. Is it logical that you can pick up fire and not get burned? No, that's not really logical. That's going to happen to you. Can one go upon hot coals and his feet not be burned? Now, I realize there are people who try to do that. And we won't comment about what powers they're using. But God says, you don't want to do that because your feet are going to get burned. And I think for most of us, we would recognize, I don't have to try that out. Now, you can get up next to some hot coals and you don't have to figure, you know, you don't sit there and think, I wonder if I could walk on those things. You know, when I finish grilling this, whatever it is, on the barbecue, I think I'll just dump the coals out and walk on them a while. See if I can get away with that. I don't think you do that. You know that. You've come to understand it, and, you know, nobody has to keep an eye on you. You know, your wife is not standing in the house saying, I'm going to watch him. He's going to walk on the coals again. You know, you don't have to do that. You've learned it's not going to work. So God says, if you can see that physically, why can't you see it spiritually? Why can't you recognize the same is true spiritually? So he that goes in to his neighbor's wife, whosoever touches her shall not, the King James says, be innocent. It's a lot better in the Jewish translation. Whosoever touches her shall not go unpunished. There's no such thing as escaping the result. Men do not despise a thief if he steal to satisfy his soul when he's hungry. But if he's found, he shall restore sevenfold or many times over. He shall give all the substance of his house. He may lose everything because of it, but at least he is not despised because people understand, well, at least he was doing it because he was hungry. But whoso commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He that does it destroys his own soul. A wound and dishonor shall he get, and his reproach shall not be wiped away. It is a tremendous scar. But so many people think, oh, I can get close. I won't go over the line. Certainly, I would never do this particular thing. If we're talking about adultery in this case, oh, I would never commit adultery. No, I would never want to do that. But you get so close. It's so close to the edge, and then something happens. Something happens. It might be adultery, it might be some other sin. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul addressed that problem in the Corinth of his day. Corinth in his day was morally the equivalent of many large cities of our day. Harlotry was common. Homosexuality, a number of other problems. Quite common. So Paul told the people in 1 Corinthians 6 in verse 18, flee fornication. Every sin that a man does is without the body, but he that commits fornication sins against his own body, destroying himself. Don't see how close you can get. Get away from it. Now I mentioned the example in Bible study a while back, quite a number of years ago, when Ambassador College was young. There were a number of students who made a trip to Mexico. And they were down in Tijuana. And they missed Dr. Hay. Of course, he wasn't Dr. Hay then. He was just Herman. But they missed him. He was gone. They couldn't find him. And all of a sudden, he looked down the street, and here came Herman running just as fast as he could go. And what had happened is he had gotten out to explore around the area, and he'd gotten propositioned. And it said, flee, and he fled. He did not stand around to reason. He did not say, you don't want to get involved in that kind of thing. He didn't preach. He fled. And he avoided the problem. I mean, he did fulfill what it said. Though he, in that case, fled literally. The principle should still be there for all of us. Flee. Get away from it. Don't think you can handle it. You make so many mistakes. We make so many mistakes when we think we can handle it. We can deal with it. It's not going to affect me. 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Here's one that's very common in this world today. 1 Timothy 6, we'll begin in verse 9. But they that will or desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is, as it's better put, a root of all evils, which while some coveted after, they've erred from the faith, and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But you, O man of God, flee these things, and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness. You flee from them. The danger is there. You have a great desire to be wealthy, to have the trappings of this world. Okay, you're going to suffer. You're setting yourself up for problems. So many times the approach of many people is, how close to sin can I get? And it still won't be sin. Or said another way, how much can I be like the world and still be acceptable to God? How much can I still do just like I always did before I ever knew God's way? And God will still accept me. What's the minimum God will accept? Sometimes the examples are quite obvious. For example, let's say alcohol. Some people want to know, well, how much alcohol can I drink and not be guilty of sin? I don't know. It depends on you. There are some people who can't drink it at all without it being sin. And they have to face that and deal with it. There are other people who might have one drink and be fine, but two is too much. There are others for whom two might be all right. And there are different situations that may come up, depending on what you're involved in doing. If you're going to be driving, maybe two's too many. Maybe one's too many. But each individual has to look at that. We're not going to give you an absolute standard and say, here it is, you may have this many drinks in 24 hours. We did that at one time. I remember it a number of years ago. It goes back to the mid-60s, but I remember it when the statement was you could have two drinks in 24 hours. And I've known of people who would say, okay, my 24 hours starts at 6 p.m. I'll have two of them at 5 and I'll have two of them at 6. And that's my two for this 24 hours and my two for this 24 hours. And somehow think, I haven't sinned. Because after all, they said two every 24 hours. Some people tried to live by that standard, and they still haven't caught up. They're already up into the 1990s already. You have to look at yourself and say, all right, what can I handle? What is proper for me? It may be different for different people in that way, but I'm talking about the approach. The approach of saying, well, I can have this much, and I'm not drunk. But if I had one more, I would be over the line. So therefore, every time, I'm going to get just as close as I can. A little bit closer each time. If you know anything about it, you realize that the basic condition of your body is going to affect you differently at different times. But alcohol is an obvious example. Another one that comes up from time to time. The length of a lady's skirt. Well, now, how long can it... Or no, that isn't the way we want it. How short can it be and still not be sinful? Why do we have to take that approach? No, I'm not going to define it for you. I'm not going to give you a length and say, okay, ladies, here's your length. It can be this long. that's not appropriate. Some of those styles may change from time to time. But we recognize there's a principle of being modest, and that principle always applies. It isn't affected by what society says. It isn't affected by what some designer in Paris or Rome or Big Sandy says. It doesn't change that. Modesty is a law, a principle that applies at all times. It should be followed. But sometimes we want, well, how close can I get? Can it be, you know, we had at one time, we said, okay, knee length. Okay, bottom of the knee or top of the knee? You know, and we want to get this, you know, well, mid-knee. Well, what if it's a quarter inch shorter than that? Is that when you're standing or seated or whatever? And it gets to be a ridiculous thing, because instead of saying, wait a minute, I don't want to get close to sin. I don't even want to be close. Therefore, I want to make sure I'm far enough from the edge that it's no problem. We have the same thing with hair length, especially where men are concerned, or hairstyles even at times. I know as I sat at the back today, I looked around and I saw a number of our young people that frankly need a haircut. You fellows don't need your hair coming down lapping all over your collar. It doesn't need to be there. Now, is it sin? I'm not going to define that for you. God says it's a shame, which obviously implies sin, for a man to have long hair. The obvious approach we ought to take is, I want to be far enough from the edge that it's not a question. Now, you don't have to look like Neil Frank, you know, if you watch him. I'm not saying everybody has to have, you know, a flat top and short white walls and so on. We're not saying that. We're not advocating that that's exactly what it has to be. But why should it be such a problem? Why is it a constant thing to have to remind people? Why should a pastor have to spend his time walking around grabbing people's hair? So don't you think this needs to be cut? Our attitude ought to be, if I don't want sin in my life, I want to get as far from it as I can get. We talked about hairstyles. You know, there are the styles maybe you saw even the other day if you watched the so-called football game Sunday. You saw that there were players who had strange haircuts. Some who have names cut in their hair. Or perhaps you've seen some of the styles where it's, you know, real short on one side. It looks like the whole head is tilted. You know, it kind of goes off. And what in the world is going on in some of these styles? Or as we've talked about, women who look like their hair was designed by an explosion in a gas oven. That should not be. Why do we want to be that? See, we shouldn't be saying, I want to be as much like the world as I can. Can I wear my hair this way and still be all right? When those things, those styles, whether we're talking dress or hair, whatever it may be, represent attitudes, they make a statement. And many times they make statements that we as Church of God shouldn't be saying. They represent rebellion, and they're something that we shouldn't be saying. It's not right. So we could look at some of those obvious examples. There are many others as well. There's an overall principle that we talked about before, so I'll just refer to Romans 14, verse 23. Whatever is not of faith is sin. So therefore, we ought to examine and say, I want to stay as far from sin as I can. One more reason why people sin. One more wrong pattern of thinking. And that is that people sin because they lack spiritual vision. They lack spiritual vision. Sin often looks appealing. It looks like the way to get what we want. Paul wrote in Hebrews 11, verse 25, he talked about sin. He talked about Moses not wanting to take part in the pleasures of sin for a season. Moses could see the pleasures of sin. God never said sin has no pleasure. He simply said it's only for a season. And we need to have the spiritual perspective to recognize that season is not worth it. That season isn't worth it. It doesn't produce what we want. We're told in Hebrews 12 and verse 1, it refers to sin which does so easily beset us. Sin's an easy way. And it seems in this world, everybody wants the easy way. What's the easy way to do it? Tell me the easy way to accomplish this or that. You ever watch diet ads? Some of us watch them religiously. And you will find that virtually everyone promises you the easy way. You'll see some that say, you know, take this little pill and you can eat whatever you want. The only thing I can figure is that little pill makes you real sick. That's all I can figure. No, they want you to have the easy way. Do it the easy way. Learn another language the easy way. I don't think there is an easy way. But we promise the easy way. Sin is the easy way. It looks so easy. It looks like the easy way to produce what we want. Proverbs 23. Proverbs 23, verse 17. Proverbs 23, verse 17. He says, "Let not your heart envy sinners, but be you in the fear of the Lord all the day long." Don't look at those who are living the wrong way and become envious. It's an easy thing to do. Chapter 24, verse 1. "Be not you envious against," or better put, "of evil men, neither desire to be with them." Don't lack that vision and think that that's going to produce what you want. Verse 19 of this same Proverbs chapter 24. "Fret not yourself because of evil men, neither be you envious at the wicked, for there shall be no reward to the evil man. The candle of the wicked shall be put out." God tells us over and over, this is the result. Proverbs 7. Proverbs 7, verse 25. Again, it talks about sexual immorality. "Let not your heart decline to her paths. Go not astray in her paths, for she has cast down many wounded. Yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Her house is the way to hell or the grave, going down to the chambers of death." Proverbs 5, verse 8. Proverbs 5, verse 8. "Remove your way far from her. Come not near the door of her house." Don't get close to it. Don't lack the vision and think that you really can handle it. Sometimes we don't really believe God, though we believe in God. God's told us the result of certain courses of action. Sometimes we just don't believe it. We believe something else will happen if I follow that course. Without spiritual vision, we allow ourselves to have priorities that are totally wrong. Proverbs 19, and this one I think is a proverb for the 20th century. Proverbs 19 and verse 2. "Also that the soul be without knowledge, it's not good." That ought to sound familiar. "That the soul is without knowledge is not good. And he that hastes with his feet sins." What, this is somebody who dances fast sins? As long as you dance slowly, it's all right? No. It simply means when you haste with your feet, what are you doing? You're going madly from one thing to another. You're constantly on the go. You're constantly having your life dictated by time pressures, instead of you being in control and determining what your priorities are. And it says, if you allow yourself to have your life controlled by all these time pressures on you, you're going to get involved in sin. In some cases, you sin because you don't adequately consider what you're doing. In other cases, you sin, frankly, because you go and go and go to the point where you're so tired. You let down. You don't exercise the control that you normally could have. And you get involved in sin. We don't have time, but we could go through all of Psalm 73, where David talked about the result of having the wrong priorities, of lacking the vision, of not seeing on down the road. He said, "I looked at these wealthy people, and look at all they have. They have so much." And finally, when he gets toward the end of that psalm, he says, "Then understood I their end. Then I grasped it. Then I began to see, and I realized," he says, I believe it's verse 22, "so foolish was I and ignorant, I was as a beast before God." We need to look at things in that way. We need to examine our priorities. Do we have the right perspective on our lives? Because in a sense, our priorities must be God's priorities. God's priorities are first. Ours have to be entirely secondary. What are the priorities in your life? Are you on the path that's going to reach those goals? It's going to reach the goals that you said that you really want. Is the path you're following right now going to produce that? When I look at priorities, I have to wonder sometimes. If the greatest priority of all is to become more and more like Jesus Christ so we may be born into the family of God at the return of Christ, then we ought to look at ourselves and say, am I living that way? Am I? I wonder for a variety of reasons. I wonder sometimes as I look at myself, and I wonder sometimes as I look at the congregation. I wonder when I see that over 2/3 of the congregation doesn't even think it's worth their time to be in Bible study once a week. I say, are we really setting our priorities where we should? Every one of us needs to examine ourselves, because if we lack the spiritual vision, we're going to go into sin. And sin will produce death. Now, we've examined 7 different defective thought patterns that produce sin. Next time, I already have next time outlined, so I can tell you. Next time, we're going to talk about what steps we must take to get sin out of our lives once and for all. God willing, we'll see you next week.